Buying or selling your home? Real Estate for Life can connect you with a pro-life real estate agent. When Real Estate for Life receives a referral fee, they donate 65% to Catholic Answers. Learn more at realestateforlife.org.
Hello and welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. Thomas Graff, social media manager here at Catholic Answers, filling in for Cy Kellett on a show so nice we got to do it twice. Had such a great time with Joe Heschmeyer answering questions about the Eucharist in the first hour. We decided, let's run it back. Let's do it all over again. We got a lot more callers on the line waiting to talk to Joe about the Eucharist, and they're all full. I'll give out the number anyway, just in case someone drops out. It's 888-318-7884. Call that number over and over again, because you might be able to slip in when someone drops off the line. But that is the number, 888-318-7884. Joe, I mentioned earlier, plugged Shameless Popery, of course, as we should do. And of course, I completely neglected to mention that more recent than the episode I was pumping up, is an episode you put out that is actually about the Eucharist itself. So why don't you tell the people what that episode is about?
Oh yeah, I mean it's actually very similar to one of the calls that already happened. And so St. Paul in 1 Corinthians 10 and 11 uses the term bread, and specifically loaf, arton, to describe Christ present in the Eucharist even after the consecration. And out of context, that sounds like, oh, well, I guess it's just bread. When you look at the actual words he's saying, where he calls it a participation in the body of Christ and a participation in the blood of Christ, and warns that those who receive it unworthily will be damned, it's clear he's not just talking about ordinary bread, that rather he seems to be using bread in the same way that the Gospels use bread. Like when Jesus describes himself as the bread of life, we don't think that he means he is literally bread. So we would say there, he's using a very obvious image that the bread that Jesus will give for the life of the world is his flesh, and that he is our one bread, he is our one loaf. That when we say like one bread, one body, this is not a denial of transubstantiation. This is pointing to this well-established biblical image for Christ, given to us by Christ himself.
Shameless Popery on YouTube, Shameless Popery wherever you get your podcasts. I've actually pulled up the YouTube page in front of me so I can tell you everyone what the exact title is this time. It's Do St. Paul's Words Disprove the Catholic Eucharist? So if you want a much deeper dive into what you just heard from Joe there, go to Shameless Popery, again, on YouTube or wherever you get your podcasts. Joe, ready to dive back into calls?
Yeah, let's do it.
Then let's dive to Oklahoma, where the John from Oklahoma, a regular caller, glad to have him back again listening on Sirius XM, is calling. John, welcome back to the show.
Hey, man. First caller, second hour. I'll take it. I love it.
Teeing it right up for us. Good job.
Nice. Now, I am very excited about Lent coming up because you had mentioned Lent. This is the very first Lent as an actual Catholic that I'm going to
Hey, let's go.
And I am just ecstatic. Yes.
That's wonderful.
Ah, man. So I love the Eucharist. I love the Eucharistic adoration. I go, because I'm a truck driver, I go to as many adoration chapels or adorations in the main church that I can find whenever I go to a place to deliver. And I just love it and the importance of it. I can't stress it enough. If they want to grow in their Catholicism and in their faith, go to Eucharistic adoration.
Amen.
I mean, it will absolutely change you.
Amen.
Here's my question. When did the practice of Eucharistic adoration actually begin?
It's a slightly tricky question because we have monks in the early days of the church from at least like the 300s who we know reserved the Eucharist in their cell. So if you're a monk living in the desert and you live in a little cell by yourself and you're not a priest who can consecrate the Eucharist, then you need to receive the Eucharist from someone else. And so they would receive the Eucharist and be able to communicate themselves periodically after that. And so we know that they had the Eucharist reserved in their cell. We know of some other cases. I believe Basil the Great did this as well, where he saved a portion of the Eucharist in a reserved place, also in the 300s. And so that, I think, would be the earliest evidence we have of the Eucharist being reserved. Also in the 300s, there's a reference Ambrose gives in a funeral homily for his brother, where he talks about his brother having been on a ship, and when the ship sunk, they have the Eucharist wrapped up in a cloth. I think the English translation says a napkin, but it means like a cloth. And he wraps this around his neck, and he floats to sea, knowing that God will protect him. So it seems that there is some reservation of the Eucharist on this ship as well. As with a monk in the desert, a sailor at sea can't make it to Mass in the ordinary way. And so it makes sense that the Eucharist would be stored on board. So that seems to be some of our earliest evidence of the Eucharist being reserved, how people acted towards it in terms of offering set prayers. A lot of our knowledge of the particular prayers comes much later. That's partly the nature of prayer. People don't usually write down their prayers in any kind of concrete or systematic way, unless it's, a group kind of liturgical prayer. But something like adoration, if you were to say, in the last, 5 years, how many of my prayers at adoration have been written down? Probably not many. So when we're dealing with the history here, we know we're dealing with kind of a piecemeal history, because not only is most papyrus gone, but in particular, prayer is the kind of thing that often is not very well preserved in the historical record, even though we know it happens, the kind of details of it. But even, so I mentioned those examples from the 300s, but if you go back even earlier to like the 100s, Justin Martyr talks about, I believe it's the deacons who would bring the Eucharist to the sick. So that suggests that there are people who reserved the Eucharist outside of Mass, at least for the purpose of bringing it to the sick. We don't really know all the details of what that looked like in terms of where they kind of stored the Eucharist. The idea of a standing tabernacle in the church is slightly later. I believe shortly after the First Council of Nicaea in 325, there's more of a push for having an appropriate place for the Eucharist in those contexts that is, that fits the dignity of the Eucharist. So pretty early on, but the exact details of that are somewhat murky. And then a lot of what we think of now with adoration in terms of being more of like you have benediction in those prayers, a lot of those prayers are actually much later into, like the Middle Ages.
John, does that help you out?
When did the monstrance come into play? When did they decide to add a monstrance?
I may be wrong about this. I believe 9th century, something like that. And so monstrance comes from the word monstrare, to show. And so it's a way of displaying the Eucharist. I'm not 100% sure, but I believe it is something like the 9th century. But I could be completely wrong about that.
John, you might have stumped Joe. Ooh,
oh,
yeah.
Tough.
Hey, man. Wow.
I know. Right. I don't want to commit too much just in case. Because, again, this is one of those things where, like, the particulars of how the Eucharist is stored and displayed in this case, you're going to have diversity of style, and, we're going to be limited in what we know in terms of the archaeological and historic record.
Mm-hmm. Well, thanks so much for that call, John. Always lovely to hear from you. Thanks for kicking us off on that first hour. That was a great answer by Joe. Much better than the answer I would have given to when did Eucharistic adoration start. I would have just said the first Christmas. But that I don't think that's what John wanted to know. If you want to know.
After benediction?
The first Christmas after benediction.
No, I'm saying Eucharistic adoration starts after you do benediction.
Oh, yeah. Benediction. Thank you, Joe. See, I was too dumb to even get that.
Every time you go to adoration, yeah.
Yes, when it starts. That's what I said. See, and if you want to know why none of those answers are what John was looking for, just yes, rewind to the very beginning of this show where we talked about modes of presence, and then you'll understand why. So that brings us mercifully to our first break. I do need to let you know before we go. There's one thing we should all be doing, but probably aren't or not enough. Two things, actually. I'm not eating enough vegetables. But the other thing we should be doing, but probably aren't, is talking about Jesus with anyone. Anyone at all, evangelizing, fulfilling the call to evangelize, spreading the good news about Jesus Christ. And we want to help you do that. We want to help you get the confidence and the know-how and just a little bit of skills that you can use to talk about Jesus with anyone. So we wrote a book. We published a book titled How to Talk About Jesus with Anyone. It's by Cy Kellett, the host that I'm filling in for, and Steve Dawson, the founder of St. Paul Street Evangelization. If you go to our website, talkaboutjesusbook.com, talkaboutjesusbook.com, you can order that for only $4 in bulk. So a bulk order of, I believe, probably 20 books for $4 each. You can also order it in single, in any format you want. Talkaboutjesusbook.com will teach you tested techniques for planting seeds and saving souls. How to talk about Jesus with anyone. Talkaboutjesusbook.com. Visit it today, and you can start. You can continue the work of evangelization that saints and doctors and thousands and millions of Christians have done throughout the ages. We will be right back to talk more about the Eucharist with Joe Heschmeyer right after this.
Stay with us for more Catholic Answers Live.
Underwriting for Catholic Answers Live is provided by Magnificat. Published monthly, Magnificat features texts of daily Mass, prayers, articles, meditations, art commentaries, and more, in step with the liturgical rhythm of the Church, on the web at Magnificat.com.
Hey, this is Michael O'Neill, the Miracle Hunter. I'll be delving into the fascinating world of miracles and taking you on a hunt that explores the greatest mysteries and marvels of the Catholic Church. I'll be examining what constitutes a miracle, how miracles are investigated and approved, and the role they play in the lives of the faithful. We'll look at the miracles of the Gospels and early Christianity, considering the claims of the miraculous in our own modern age.
The Miracle Hunter, Saturday at 1 p.m. and 7 p.m. Eastern on EWTN Radio.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. My name is Thomas Graff, the social media manager, filling in for Cy Kellett as he's on the road. We are talking about the Eucharist. It's an Ask Me Anything About the Eucharist hour. Not me, of course. I will not be answering the questions. Joe Heschmeyer will be answering the questions. Staff apologist here at Catholic Answers and author of books like The Eucharist Is Really Jesus. That really qualifies Joe to answer any question that you want to throw at him. Except when did the first adoration start? Because then we'll just talk about it in really punny ways, and that doesn't help anyone at all. Joe did give a very good answer to that question, then I just derailed it at the end there.
I looked a little bit, by the way, on the break on monstrances.
Oh, good.
And I saw something saying that monstrances as we currently have them start in like the 15th century. That seems very late, given that we had things like Corpus Christi. And you have the Eucharist being displayed in other ways. So this might be referring to a particular style of month. I don't know. So all that's to say, it's a good question.
All that's
I
to say,
I still don't know.
The jury is still out on the monstrance question. Maybe you can write a book on that. And it might sell tens of copies. Let's go now to Joseph, who wants to talk to Joe, calling from Nashville, Tennessee, watching on YouTube. Joseph, welcome to Catholic Answers Live. You're on the air.
Hello, guys. Thank you for taking my call. First things first, Joe, congrats on the last debate. I have shared that Star Wars bit with more people than I can imagine. So very, very good job there.
Thank you.
Now, my
Appreciate
question
that.
For you is actually about – you're welcome – is actually about Holy Thursday, because we talk about the Eucharist as this representation of Calvary, and yet that sacrifice would not have happened yet on Holy Thursday. So should we see – the Eucharist of Holy Thursday the same way that we look at the Eucharist now?
He is presenting it to be offered at Holy Thursday. And then when he commands to do this, the priests are participating in this action. So they are representing it. He is presenting it. So there is a difference there. It's the same Christ, of course. St. Thomas Aquinas, if you want to do a much deeper dive on this, Part 3 of the Summa, question 81, talks about the institution of the Eucharist, and he addresses both, did Christ receive his own body, in question 1, in article 1. In article 3, he talks about whether he gives himself as a passible or impassible body, because, you know, now the body that he has will never die. But on Holy Thursday, his body was not only capable of dying, it was about to die. And then in Article 4, he talks about what about like on Holy Saturday? How do you make sense of the fact that on Holy Saturday, you know, hypothetically, if the apostles were to offer the Mass on Holy Saturday, what would happen then since Christ's body is in the tomb? So it's a fascinating question to kind of hypothetically imagine, but I think the easiest basic answer is at Holy Thursday, Christ is presenting his body and blood. And this is relevant because John 10 makes very clear that no one takes Jesus's life from him. He lays it down freely. And so in sacrificial terms, Jesus is not just the victim of the sacrifice, he is the priest of the sacrifice. If someone just killed Jesus without his consent, that would have done nothing for the salvation of the world. Jesus freely offering himself, giving of himself, laying down his life for his friends, that is the love that is bigger than the weight of all the sins of the world. That's pretty significant. So it's actually not enough for Jesus to be the victim of the sacrifice. He has to be the priest. And I stress this because there are a lot of Protestant theologies, like penal substitutionary atonement, that seem to make Jesus simply the victim and maybe the Father, the priest of the sacrifice, that he's just pouring out his wrath on the Son. But it's not clear that this is self-sacrificial, that Jesus is actually presenting himself to the Father in the sacrifice. And so, you know, this is a critical moment theologically, because Christ is our high priest. And this is the Hebrews talks about this repeatedly. Christ is our high priest, and he begins by making the offering of himself at the Last Supper. So this is an important moment to get. This is where Christ is exercising his high priesthood, and then all earthly priests are simply cooperating in that, following that do this kind of command.
Joseph, how does that help you?
Yeah, that's great. Thank you, guys. Have a blessed
day. Yeah, you bet.
You're welcome, Joseph. Thank you for calling in. Let's move on now to Owensboro, Kentucky, where Kevin is listening on Save Your Radio. Kevin, thanks for your patience and waiting to get on the air, and here you are. Go ahead with your question.
Yeah, thanks for taking my call. And first, just want to say I appreciate y'all's work, and Joe, really appreciate the videos that you do. They're real thorough.
Thank you.
I appreciate them. My question is, so it's come to my understanding that in John 6, in the original Greek, there's a different word used for eat in verses 54 through 58 that's better understood or translated like as to chew or to munch. I'm just curious why none of our translations use that difference, that different word in
John 6. It's tricky because I just pulled up the Strong's Concordance for trogo, which is the word you're talking about there. And it gives it as to gnaw, crunch, chew raw vegetables or fruits as nuts or almonds. And it's used of animals feeding first and then of men second. That's the first definition. The second definition is to eat. So chew is closer to literal. It's not a perfect, but it certainly seems to involve chewing. Even if you look at the structure of where the word comes from, it involves like the chewing action with the teeth and what it does to the teeth. So there's a gnawing, tearing kind of connotation to it. Nevertheless, every time it appears in the New Testament, so most of the time it appears in the New Testament, it's in John 6. It's four times there. But there are two other times where it's used. John 13:18, he that gnaws my bread, or he that eateth bread with me, as the KJV has. And then the other one is in Matthew 24, where people are eating and drinking in the days of Noah. And there it clearly just means eating and drinking. Well, eating and then drinking is given with it. In the context of John 6, this switch of verbiage is a clear intensifier. And so I actually agree with you. I think it'd be great if we had some way of signaling that in the English, because we lose this. In the context of John 6, so for anyone who maybe doesn't have it in front of them, Jesus has talked about the need to eat his flesh. And at first, people thought this was just a metaphor. And when he talks about himself as the bread from heaven, they just think that he means he came from heaven. They don't think any of this stuff about eating is literal at all. But then, beginning in John 6:35, he doubles down on this. He says that he's the bread of life, and then he talks about the need to actually eat his flesh. And that's where they say that he's just, you know, the bread from heaven. They don't think anything particularly of this. But then he says in verse 51, I'm the living bread which came down from heaven. If anyone eats of this bread, he will live forever. And the bread which I shall give for the life of the world is my flesh. So notice he's leaning into the imagery of flesh there. And it's only then in verse 52 that they first ask, how can this man give us his flesh to eat? Now, there's two things to notice there. One, people sometimes say, well, you know what? Why does it matter if people understood Jesus in that way? People misunderstood Jesus all the time. And there's some truth to that. But in all the other examples you can find in the Bible, what you have are cases where people hear something Jesus says, and they immediately rush to kind of the wrong conclusion. And frequently, Jesus clarifies. Or if he doesn't, you know, the evangelist will clarify that they're misunderstanding things. But here, they don't rush to the Eucharistic kind of read. They originally just think he's talking about giving them free food, and then they think he means that he just came from heaven, that it's just like the bread part's just a metaphor. He doesn't actually mean to be eaten in any way. And it's only after he keeps reiterating this point that they finally say, how can this man give us his flesh to eat? So that looks like Jesus wants them to think that, because he has led them very deliberately down the road to thinking this. And then you look at how he responds to it, and it's really remarkable. As you say, there's a verb switch where he goes from saying something like eat the flesh to gnaw the flesh, where it's a more intensive. But then he also says, and drink his blood. Now, drinking of blood, besides the gross cannibalistic context, you couldn't drink animal blood. You couldn't even have meat with animal blood in it in the Old Testament, because it was viewed as a sign of communion in the life of the animal, because the life of the thing is in the blood, as Leviticus says. And so you would be communion, like if you had like meat that wasn't thoroughly cooked and it still had blood in it, that was an act of communion in the life of that beast. And that was viewed as bestial. It was beneath your dignity as a human. And so here, when Christ doubles down both by the verb switch for eating, but also doubles down by adding the drinking of blood, I think we miss that, partly because we've maybe heard the verse so many times, partly because we aren't coming from that same Mosaic background, partly because the English translation doesn't use different verbs for eat and to gnaw. But it's really significant, and it's right there in John 6:53. And then he does it again in 54. He again says, he who eats my flesh and drinks my blood, but it's gnaws my flesh and drinks my blood, has eternal life, and I'll raise him up at the last day. So there is this very strong kind of repeated language. And then he says in 55, for my flesh is food indeed, and my blood is drink indeed. So Jesus seems to be doing everything he can to double down on this language, to emphasize in even shocking ways that this is not simply a metaphor, that he means something that's very corporeal. He means something very bodily. And that somehow we need to be receiving his body and his blood, or we're cutting ourselves off from eternal life. We won't be raised up on the last day. So yeah, I think you're right to ask about kind of the verbiage there. There's much more that could be said there. But yeah, what say you, Kevin?
Yeah, I mean, that's what I heard. I just want to confirm. And it's just, I kind of wish we had translations that reflected that, to your point, to help bringing home that there's a change in Eli's meeting to chew his flesh.
Yeah, I just think there's the same thing in John 21, where, you know, he speaks to Peter three times. Simon, do you love me more than these? Simon, do you love me? Simon, do you love me? There's a verb switch in that third one, where he goes from the agape to philia. So it's almost like, Simon, do you love me more than these? And then lowers it to, Simon, do you love me? To, Simon, do you like me? And Simon each time responds by using philios. So he's using the much more fraternal kind of love. And we lose all of that in English without a bunch of footnotes, that there is this real, whereas earlier Peter had very, very bombastically said, like in Luke 22, even if everyone else should deny you, I won't deny you. And Jesus has to tell him that he's going to. In John 21, Peter is chastened, and he's humble, and even when he's asked these very big, "Do you love me more than these?" he gives a much smaller kind of answer, and it explains why the third time Peter would be hurt, both the threefold denial and the threefold affirmation, but also because Jesus is asked, "Is even that much true?" basically, and given Peter a chance to confess him three times after having denied him three times.
Kevin, thank you so much for your call. We appreciate you calling in. Call back anytime. That opens up another line. 888-318-7884 is the number to call. Joe, maybe for like the casual reader of Scripture who wants to not have all this nuance lost on him when he's reading the Bible, what can we do, do you think?
Yeah, there is unfortunately just a certain limitation in reading the Bible in translation. I mean, one answer would just be learn Greek, but that's obviously not going to be an adequate answer for most people. But I would say read the footnotes, for one, because many times the footnotes will include this kind of information. Read commentaries, read those kind of things, because you can often find things in the text that maybe are hard to convey in English, or maybe things we've just overlooked. And so this can help us to have a greater appreciation of what's actually being talked about in the Bible.
888-318-7884 is the number to call. We'll be right back with more about the Eucharist right after this.
Have you ever wondered about the mysterious, even obscure aspects of the Catholic faith? Dive into the Jimmy Akin podcast, where Jimmy brings together information from many fields as he pushes the boundaries of apologetics. Tune in today to the Jimmy Akin podcast, Mysteries of the Faith, a highly entertaining, informative, and at times humorous show that will help you grow in your faith. Visit JimmyAkinPodcast.com today to subscribe.
Lots of people have big questions about Catholicism. It needs a big book of answers, and now it's got one. The Big Book of Catholic Answers is filled with helpful replies to more than 250 questions about the faith. Questions about God, salvation history, the Creed, the Bible, the list goes on and on. Order your copy of the Big Book of Catholic Answers today at shop.catholic.com or ask for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
What was the church like in its infancy? In a word, Catholic. And Joe Heschmeyer has the receipts. In his best-selling book, The Early Church Was the Catholic Church, he gives you the details from the historical records of the first two centuries of Christianity. Right now, get a copy for just $10, plus free shipping if you live in the continental United States. Get more information and order The Early Church Was the Catholic Church at theearlychurchwascatholic.com.
What is the Catholic Church? Everyone seems to have an opinion, but the church never quite fits into the boxes people make for it. In The Faith Unboxed, author Andrew Petiprin looks at some of the most common boxes people put the Catholic Church in and explains why they don't fit. In doing so, he brings us closer to what the church really is, the institution founded by Christ. Order The Faith Unboxed today at shop.catholic.com or ask for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. We're talking to Joe Heschmeyer about the Eucharist today. 888-318-7884 is the number to call, but the lines are all full right now. Keep calling just in case someone drops out. You might be able to slip in. My name is Thomas Graff. I'm taking a break from my social media duties to fill in for Cy Kella today. And our next caller comes from Boston, Massachusetts. His name is John. He's listening on the EWTN app. John from Boston, thank you for calling in.
Blessings, everyone. Blessed Feast of St. Agnes. Three quick things. Please, listeners, support Catholic Answers, support EWTN. How can you put a price on the salvation of the soul?
Amen. Give.catholic.com. Give.catholic.com.
Yeah. Both of you, I am struggling with the English language with the word this. I mean, the profound mystery, I know that would probably be the answer for the word this. I'm trying to understand, I guess, in English grammar, during those sacred words at the transubstantiation on the altar, this is my body. I don't like the word this. It's so vague to me. So, you know, if you could provide both an English lesson to that and, of course, its meaning in terms of the Most Holy Sacrament. And just a quick footnote, perhaps the first pix was cloth, as you mentioned, about the Most Holy Sacrament being put into a cloth. St. Tarsus guarded the Eucharist next to his heart in a cloth before he was
martyred. Yeah, it's true.
But anyways.
It's true. Yeah, he was bringing the Eucharist to the sick. So we certainly know, and he wasn't even the earliest to do that. We have evidence from the 100s. So there was presumably some means of transporting the Eucharist reverently and securely. But yeah, so in terms of this is my body, this is my blood of the covenant. That's the language in Matthew 26. We're told Jesus took bread and blessed and broke it and gave it to the disciples and said, take, eat, this is my body. So if the question is, what does this refer to? Well, whatever it is, he has just given to the disciples. It had been bread, and then he blesses it, he breaks it, and he gives it, and then he declares something new. He no longer says, this is bread. He says, this is my body. So the referent, in technical language, the referent there is the distributed thing that looks like bread that they've just received. And similarly, when he takes a cup filled with wine, he lifts it up and he says, drink of it, all of you, for this is my blood of the covenant. Now, contextually, we know that he doesn't mean the cup. He means the contents of the cup, that what had previously been wine is now the blood of the covenant. So I think that you determine the meaning of this just from context. Like if I point to a kid and say, this is my son, you can tell from the context of me pointing to them that this refers to the one I'm pointing at. So likewise, when he's holding up the bread and holding up the wine, and then he prays over them and then declares, this is my body, this is the blood of the covenant, that seems to clearly indicate what it is that he's talking about there. What do you think of that, John?
Yes. Yes. Very good. Then I ask pardon. I don't even know how to phrase it. I thought that this was timeless, and then a connection to subject and object of the sentence. I said I wasn't an English major with this.
Sure.
And I agree. I agree with the context. I agree with the reference. I agree with the logic and the chronology. But that's beautiful and that's simple. And we have the command, take, right? But I'd still wrestle with the word this. I'm sorry.
Okay. Oh, yeah, it's interesting. This was actually one of the things, strikingly, that the language there is what helped Luther to maintain as much of his Eucharistic theology as he did, even though he drifted. He didn't drift as far as some of the other Protestants did, and he just kept going back to is means is. That when Jesus holds up the host and says, this is my body, we don't find him ever doing anything like that. Now, Jesus will say, like, I'm the bread of life, I'm the sheep gate, I'm the good shepherd. He'll do that. But he never just, like, picks up a shepherd and says, this is me. Or, you know, picks up a door and says, this is me. But here, when he's lifting, like, he doesn't ever use props like that and declares them to be himself. And so what's striking is that people who say this is all a metaphor have to say that in John 6, when Jesus says that the bread that he'll give for the life of the world is his flesh, he's using one set of metaphors there. He is, you know, metaphorically going to be eaten. When he talks about eating his flesh and drinking his blood, fascinatingly, you'll find Protestants who say that's not even about the Eucharist. That's a totally unrelated thing. And then at the Eucharist, when he uses the exact same sounding language, they think, well, that just means that the bread and wine represent his body and blood. Whereas before, the body and blood was literal, but the eating and the drinking was not literal. And so it's fascinating where you have to interpret these as two completely different metaphors that mean completely different things. One means something like in John 6, it means like believe or something. And at the Last Supper, it means this represents my body, but isn't really. And you just think, okay, these are very similar kind of moments. They both happen at Passover, a year apart. And Jesus is describing the need to eat his flesh and drink his blood. in the context of bread. That just feels like too big of a coincidence to divorce those things. So I would say on this score, and maybe not too many others, Martin Luther is dead on. Is means is. And so when he says, this is my body, we should take that quite seriously.
John, thanks so much for that call. We got to move along because we have a lot more callers that we want to get to. Next up is Kevin calling from North Bend, Washington, listening on the Catholic Answers app. Kevin, thanks for hanging on. You're on the air now with Joe Heschmeyer.
Hey, guys. Thanks for taking my call. So I was raised LDS or Mormon until high school, and then I converted to Christianity at my Protestant university a couple of years ago, and now I'm in OCIA. So Joe, I just wanted to say thank you for your just outreach and willingness to interact with the LDS community and just do it in good faith and trying to bring them towards Jesus.
I really appreciate that a lot.
I know you like puns.
I do.
I know you like puns, so can I tell you a lighthearted, friendly Mormon joke?
Okay, let's
careful.
I'm gonna just give it a disclaimer. I don't know what he's gonna say. Careful. So if anyone's offended,
okay,
Kevin in North Bend, you can find him.
Mormon jokes are okay, but no, puns might
I
get
love,
you dropped.
I
so
all,
we'll
I,
see.
I love all my LDS brothers and sisters. Okay, why did the Mormon have to eat his steak from a bowl?
Why?
Why did the Mormon have to eat? His
because the angel Moroni took the plates to heaven.
That's gotcha. So dumb, but I like it a lot.
Yeah, par for the course for jokes with Joe.
I know. Okay.
Yeah. You found the right audience there, Kevin.
You did.
All right.
Okay. Go ahead.
And so for my question, so in OCIA, I've been taught that the Eucharist is our highest form of worship of God. And given really the enlightening claim I've heard from you, Joe, and from others that Protestants, though often well-intentioned, have an insufficient understanding of worship. Can you explain to me the importance of the Eucharist as a sacrifice and what exactly that means?
Yeah, I'm going to give a little background, although it sounds like maybe you already know part of what I'm about to say. Biblically, there are three things that are distinguished that for many ordinary Christians we've kind of muddled together. Like if you ask people about their Sunday worship, they often have a kind of mix of what they even mean that or think that means. So these are all good things, by the way. I'm not knocking any of these. In Luke 4, Jesus goes to the synagogue. He opens up the scriptures. He preaches them from Isaiah. He then explains the scriptures to them. He's preaching and he's teaching. The synagogue is a place that he's in the habit of going. We're told that in Luke 4. But he does not regard it as a place of prayer or a place of worship. One of the ways we know that is he doesn't ever call it a place of worship or a place of prayer. And in fact, the only time prayer and the synagogue get mentioned together is in Matthew 6, when Jesus says, when you pray, don't be like the hypocrites, for they love to stand and pray in the synagogues and at the street corners. So the only thing we're told is don't pray in the synagogue. And the reason was, in the first century, before the destruction of the temple, the synagogue was not viewed as a house of prayer. The temple was. And there's plenty of actually archaeological evidence and Jewish research on this. Rabbi Reuven Hammer, I talk about him in my book, The Eucharist is Really Jesus. He looks at an ancient synagogue inscription that talks about what the synagogue was for. It's in the writing of the people in the first century. And there's no reference to prayer or worship whatsoever. That's not what it was for. It was a place to gather and read the Torah and talk about it and for visitors to come and stay. So again, none of those things are bad, but it's more like what we would say today, like a parish hall. The contrast then would be to the second activity, which is praying. In teaching and preaching, you're talking about God. You want to do that in front of a lot of people. Praying, Jesus doesn't tell you to go try to do it in front of a bunch of people. That's what the hypocrites do. Because in praying, you're talking to God. So you can do that anywhere, but he tells you to go into your room to pray. I mean, we find Jesus praying all over the place. So that's everywhere. But then there's this third thing called worship. In John 4, the Samaritan woman who's on Mount Gerizim, the holy mountain for the Samaritans, asked Jesus about this. And she says to him, this is John 4, verse 20. She says, "Sir, I perceive that you're a prophet. Our fathers worshipped on this mountain, and you say that in Jerusalem is a place where men ought to worship." So something is happening in Jerusalem, more specifically in the temple, that she is calling worship. What is that? It's sacrifice. And Jesus knows this. as Everett Ferguson points out, sacrifice is the language of worship in the ancient world. This is the primary way that people gave something to God. So you're not just talking about God as in teaching. You're not just asking God for things or talking to him as in praying. You're going even beyond that and making offerings to God. And this is what sacrifice is. This is what the whole Old Testament sacrificial system was about. This is what the cross is about. Jesus is giving something to the Father, perfect obedience, his own life, this everlasting love. This is an offering. And the question then becomes, how do we as Christians participate in the offering, the sacrifice, the worship that Jesus offers to the Father? And the answer, in part, is that we eat the sacrifice. So, two things. One, I don't mean to discount that we can worship God in other ways as well. We can make sacrifices in our bodies, and that's also worship. Romans 12:1, he says this is our spiritual worship. When you make sacrifices in the temple of your body, you are acting as a priest in that temple, your body, and you're making sacrifices that's pleasing to God. But as St. Paul says in 1 Corinthians 10, we can partake of the body and blood of Christ. And he compares it to the Jewish temple sacrifices and the pagan food sacrifices. And longish story medium, in the Old Covenant, the way you participated in a sacrifice was typically not by killing the animal. The priest did that. It might not even be by owning the animal. So for instance, like the Passover, it's a family meal. And it's okay if you can't afford a lamb yourself. You can share with the neighbor. So how do you participate in that sacrifice? By eating it. And so there's a whole realm of sacrifices that this is true for. And that's the image that Paul draws on to explain what's happening in the Eucharist. That this is the way that we participate in the body and blood of Christ is by eating his sacrificial offering. Does that make sense?
Yeah, that's awesome. Thank you.
Yeah. Hey, Kevin, do me a favor. If you stick around, I'm going to send you a copy of The Eucharist is Really Jesus, because I've got a chapter that goes into way more depth on this than I was able to kind of cover in this briefish answer.
That's right, Kevin. Just stay on the line. Darren, who you talked to earlier, when he screened your call, he will get your information and he will send you a copy of this beauty right here, The Eucharist is Really Jesus, where you can learn even more about what Joe just gave you a little cliff notes on. To answer your question. Thanks so much for your call, Kevin. And anyone else who's listening who wants to get a copy of The Eucharist is Really Jesus or any other of Joe Heschmeyer's books or any of the books we sell in general can go to shop.catholic.com right now, where we've got a store-wide discount going on, a whopping 26% discount store-wide, the 2026 26% discount store-wide. Just enter promo code SAVE26 at checkout. That's SAVE26 at checkout. And we'll take 26% off any purchase of $26 or more. So load up your cart with $26 or more of any shop.catholic.com goodies. Just like I said, Joe's book, The Eucharist is Really Jesus. The early church was the Catholic Church. Pope Peter, that ought to get you up above 26, all those three together. And put in SAVE26 at the checkout, and we will take 26% off that order. But this deal ends Sunday, 5 days away. 26% is a pretty awesome discount store-wide, so go to shop.catholic.com now in the next 5 days, and you can take advantage of that discount. Shop.catholic.com, SAVE26 at checkout. We will be right back to wrap up this last segment of this show with Joe Heschmeyer right after this.
You're listening to Catholic Answers Live. Underwriting for Catholic Answers Live is provided by Real Estate for Life. Real Estate for Life connects homebuyers and sellers to real estate agents while supporting pro-life organizations. On the web at realestateforlife.org.
This is Father John Bonavita Cola. There are many Catholic Christians who turn on the radio and they want to hear something spiritual, something about faith. So it's critical that in every area we can have Catholic radio, and that we as Catholics will continue to support this great work and for bringing the message of the gospel, the message of our beautiful Catholic faith to everyone.
The world needs EWTN Catholic Radio, now more than ever.
Who was the first Catholic in your family? Were they evangelized by a friend, a coworker, a stranger? Did you ever think that you could be that person that God uses to save a soul? and that soul could save their family, their grandchildren, and generations to come. At St. Paul Street Evangelization, a Catholic nonprofit, we train, equip, and mobilize Catholic disciples to do the urgent work of evangelization. Catholic Answers is supported in part by St. Paul Street Evangelization, streetevangelization.com.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. Been a great time hanging with you all and with Joe Heschmeyer as he answers questions about the Eucharist. Had a lot of callers on the line, and we want to get through as many as we can now, so we will head right down to Midland, Texas, where Clayton has been patiently waiting on YouTube. Clayton, thanks so much for waiting. You are on the air with Joe Heschmeyer. Go ahead with your question.
Thanks for taking my call. How are you, Joe?
Good. How are you doing?
I'm good. I kind of have two questions. So my first is, have you ever, there's kind of a popular Protestant kind of apologetics book called Reasoning from the Scriptures with Catholics. I'm just wondering, first off, if you have ever like read that, or I know I'm reading The Case for Catholicism by Trent right now, and he kind of sometimes quotes from it. I'm wondering if you have ever read
it. I'm trying to remember this is Ron Rhodes.
Yes, it is.
They're two very similar books. They both look similar and are content-wise very similar. I think I've read part of that book. I don't think I've read that one thoroughly. Mm-hmm. But I'm familiar with the book in general.
Okay. Well, anyway, so I've been reading it, and I'm kind of just learning about what the other questions are from the Protestant side. And one of the questions... as to the Eucharist is from the book, and it says, if every Catholic church all over the world has Mass every Sunday, wouldn't Jesus's human body have to be omnipresent?
I mean, first, no. It'd be multi-present if that was the right understanding of presence, but it's not. So this it's a good question. I want to be very clear about that. And I actually alluded to this in the very first question that I answered at the top of last hour, that this is very similar to a question that Gregory of Nyssa addresses in the Great Catechism in the mid-300s. So this is just a good sign that people who are objecting in this way are raising the historic objections that the enemies of Christianity raised against the early Christians. And I think it is worth addressing in those terms. Like, you're attacking the historic Christian belief in the Eucharist in the exact same way that the enemies of Christianity did. That doesn't automatically mean you're wrong, but it kind of suggests you're maybe on the wrong track. So there's a technical answer to this. And the technical answer is that Christ is present in different ways. And so, you know, where two or three are gathered, he is present, but that doesn't mean that he's leaving the right hand of the Father and returning to earth in the way that he will at the second coming. That makes sense so far?
Yes, it does.
Like, we are present to each other in a certain way now by phone. And, you know, I'm present with Thomas by video right now. And I'm present in a different way if somebody was in the room with me. So you can be present in multiple ways at the same time. And this is true just with us in our humanity, just with technology. And of course it's true for God. So this idea that Christ cannot be bodily present in multiple ways is actually insulting to the power of Christ. Ligonier Ministries has a devotional called The Presence of Christ in the Lord's Supper. And they argue that even in his glorified state, the human nature of Christ is still limited in ways that are not a consequence of the fall. His physical body, one of the aspects of his human nature, is localized in heaven. It can be no more omnipresent than our human bodies can be. Now, that strikes me as a bold claim to claim that it is impossible for God to make his body present. Nevertheless, the real issue here is that we don't believe the Eucharist is the local presence of God. That we don't believe that Jesus leaves heaven bodily at every Mass. This is an argument that is sometimes thrown at Catholics based on a very misleading quotation from a book called The Faith of Millions from like 100 years ago. And so people like James Light will quote this book out of context. But even the author of that book is clear. We don't literally think Jesus is leaving heaven every time there's a mass, or else every mass would be Armageddon. Like, the issue wouldn't actually be omnipresence, because that's not true. The issue would be if Jesus became locally present, where his body left heaven to arrive on earth, that's the event we call the second coming. That rather, he makes himself bodily present through the sacrament of the Eucharist. That's different than him leaving heaven. That in a way, when you receive Jesus bodily in the Eucharist, you're receiving the Jesus who is right now enthroned in heaven bodily in the Eucharist. Not that Jesus is leaving heaven to come to earth. Does that distinction make sense?
It does, very much.
Good. So that's what I would say to that. That, like, his body, just like, you know, Thomas can see my body right now through the medium of video, and it's still a sort of kind of mode of bodily presence, but it's not as if I was there in the room with him. That's, Christ isn't present like that, but it at least highlights the fact that you can be present in multiple ways. You can even be bodily present in multiple ways.
Clayton, thanks so much for that question. We do have to move along. We want to get as many people answered as we can before we have to go. Nathan is listening in Jackson, Mississippi on 107.9 FM. Nathan, you are on the air with Joe Heschmeyer. Go ahead with your question.
Oh.
Hi, Nathan. Do we have you?
Hello? Can y'all hear me?
Yep.
Yeah, we got you now, Nathan.
We hear you now.
All right. Well, thank y'all for taking my call.
Happy to.
Well, so I just give a little backstory. I've been raised Southern Baptist my whole life. I'm 25 years old, and but the past year I have been kind of discerning what denomination I should go to, kind of trying to figure out the truth. And thanks to you, Joe, and many others, I've actually been looking really deep into the Catholic Church.
Beautiful.
And I'm probably going to become Catholic, but
awesome.
Glory,
praise God.
I guess one of my question was, why does the church, like, obviously every parish gives out the body portion of the Eucharist, but why does the church allow certain parishes to not give out the blood portion
yeah.
of it?
Yeah, there is a doctrine called concomitance, which is that Jesus is fully present in the Eucharist, both in the host and in the chalice, because his, like, body, blood, soul, and divinity is actually united by virtue of the resurrection. So when you receive the Eucharist, you're not just receiving Jesus's body cut off from his divinity, or his body cut off from his humanity, his body cut off from his blood. You're receiving all of him, divinity and humanity, present in this bodily way in the Eucharist. And so whether you receive either or both species, you're receiving Jesus. And so you're not getting less of Jesus. It's more sacramentally significant in terms of the sign value to receive both. But in terms of the validity of the Eucharist, you can do one or either. The priest receives both, but the laity are not required to. And there's nothing actually required. Like, the do this is Jesus' command to the priest. We're never actually commanded to receive both, which is significant, I suppose. And then there's some prudential reasons. Like, if you offer both, there is an increased risk of spill. You have to have more ministers of Holy Communion, and so it can become a little more chaotic. And so some churches decide just to offer the host, or in some cases, the chalice will be offered to people who may be insensitive to gluten as well. So that is a prudential reason left to the parishes for their own discretion. But that's why, like, you're whichever way you receive, the priest is going to receive both, and whether you receive either or both, you are still receiving all of Jesus.
Nathan, does that help you out?
Okay. Yeah, and I guess I know, like, other Protestants will use the argument of, like, you know, at the Last Supper, I believe is what it was, he said, God, or Jesus said that the do both of them.
Yeah, but he's speaking to his priests there, and his priests do receive
yeah.
both.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say. I guess that would be your response, is because he's talking to the apostles, which would be the priests and stuff like that. And so
mm-hmm.
exactly. not just the laity.
Right.
Yeah. Okay.
He doesn't give explicit commands for how the laity are to receive at all. And so for a lot of church history, in the West at least, the laity received just under one kind. It's fine to receive under either and both. Real quick, because I know there's two callers who didn't get a chance to get their question answered. Jeff wanted to know Eucharistic prayers. Priests can decide which one to use, and they often don't do the fourth one because it's long. And then Marie is pointing, Benzi is pointing out that in Exodus, after the blood of the covenant is presented, the elders went up and behold Christ and ate and drank, which is significant in prefiguring the Eucharist.
Such Look at that. Beautiful. Joe answering questions with 15 seconds to spare. Thanks for a great show, Joe.
My pleasure.
And thank you all for listening. We'll be right back with you tomorrow, God willing, right here on Catholic Answers Live.